Hello and welcome to the Late Kickoff Football Podcast. In a week where Roy Hodgson finally gets his wonder kids back together and silences a difficult Sheffield United challenge, they then both go off injured. The City juggernaut continues its astonishing record against Burnley, and even with Kyle Walker sidelined for some minor personal indiscretions, they find a way to victory. Newcastle continue their hold over Aston Villa, despite having the worst away record in the league against the best home record in the league. And on transfer deadline day, the biggest transfer news in the world right now isn't coming from football. It's coming from F1, with the news that Lewis Hamilton might be off to Ferrari. I'm Jamie Guyon, host of the Late Kickoff Football Podcast, and joining me this week, as ever, is Mike Wood. Mike, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. I enjoyed our F1 chat off air. I think it's more entertaining than some of the football this weekend, of course.
Yeah, exactly. It's been a funny week. There's been a lot of interesting games with very uninteresting consequences. And we were just double-checking we hadn't missed any major news stories before we started recording, only to be shocked, absolutely shocked by the news that Lewis Hamilton could be playing in red next season. So for anybody that listens to this pod that's also an F1 fan, I'm sure that'll probably be the news that takes up your day rather than anything particular that we're about to talk about. But hopefully you stick with us. There is some interesting talking points on and off the pitch. We're going to start with the Premier League as always, but given the news that came yesterday, we're obviously going to have to carry on to Aberdeen and have a chat about the changes that are going on at Pittodrie. Without further ado, though, we'll start with Liverpool off the field, and we'll get on to their terrific 4-1 victory against Chelsea last night. But perhaps the biggest news coming out of football was last Friday with Jurgen Klopp's announcement that he would be leaving Liverpool at the end of the season. Seems to have caught even the most in-the-know journalists by surprise. You know, it's a well-kept secret if Fabrizio Romano hasn't broken it 2.5 days before it was finally announced, and one that has obviously led to a lot of interest and discussion. I was certainly surprised, Mike, not in a I'm meant to be in the know and I didn't know way, but just in a general didn't see that one coming way. I presume you were pretty surprised as well. What were your initial thoughts?
Yeah, I thought, well, you signed that contract extension in, I think, maybe April 2022, and before that, I always said kind of before, I'm not sure if I can go past 2024 in terms of the news that there was going to be, he might be taking a sabbatical around that time, back when that story was kind of breaking it. So I'm not surprised in the sense that he's kind of called that day, because when you look at what's potentially down the line with the German job, it's kind of convenient timing. But I'm surprised that it was announced this early, but I suppose he wanted to do it on his own terms. He told the owners in November that he probably doesn't have the energy for it. I think the way he's been talking about the job, in a sense, it's not that he's he feels unable to do the job because his manager style relies on the energy and having that kind of passion. We see that on the sidelines quite often. We see that the way that his teams play. And he just doesn't feel like he can keep going and keep pushing himself. And he's been doing it. Well, he's been doing management role for a long time. I think he's only not been a manager over the last 22 or 23 years for the space of about 6 months when he left Dortmund before he joined Liverpool as well. And that's Mainz, his time at Mainz as well. So he's been at this gig for a long, long time without any real kind of sort of break and respite. So I'm not surprised that he's kind of feeling depleted. And listen, none of us are getting any younger. And by no means is he an old man, but you can see that he's kind of won everything at Liverpool. He's rebuilt it quicker than probably perhaps anybody anticipated, perhaps even himself. So he's not like leaving the club in a lurch. So it's maybe the best time for all if he feels he can't go another 18 months, another year, to the end of his contract to kind of passively move on, give the board as much time as possible to find a replacement. And kind of, he says, ideally win everything and just kind of leave with his head held high. And I can't blame him. He's been an asset to the Premier League for all these years, and he'd be greatly missed for, even though he's throws a tantrum ever so often once he gets beat, but for pure entertainment and pure value and for what he comes across as a person a lot of the time, it's genuine. He'll be a real miss, especially on this podcast, I believe.
Yeah, he is a character, to say the least, in an era with less and less characters. He's a more than sour-faced bastard when it's not going his way, but then I guess that's why he's so good at it. It was interesting. It was interesting timing because I think we've spoken on the podcast quite a lot this season about how he's managed to revitalise that Liverpool team, like we say, perhaps quicker than we expected. They struggled last year with without Fabinho, and Henderson obviously wasn't playing quite to the levels that he had been before, and there was a lot of feeling that the team needed to be freshened up. And then very, very quickly, and it seemed quite easily, he did manage to freshen up. Maybe that's caught him by surprise a little bit. Perhaps this was already in his mind, as you said, that this was going to be his last season, and then the team's doing slightly better than he expected. But he very much strikes you as the kind of person that sticks to his guns once he makes a decision like that. And you only have to look at a picture of him from when he took over the Liverpool job to see how much it's aged him in the last 9 years. Like he's aged at least, 15 to 20 years in that time. So it's obviously a very stressful gig. And in terms of football, Mike, he'll probably go down, I would have thought, in that sort of top four, well, he definitely will, won't he, for now, in that top four or five Premier League managers of all time. You've got the Wenger-Fergie rivalry, which sort of started the Premier League. You've kind of got Jose Mourinho as this isolated, crazy figure that was the figurehead of the change that sort of came in the early 2000s with the significant external investment. And then you've got the Klopp and Pep era that's been around now since the mid-2010s, and the sort of second major rivalry in Premier League history. And Klopp and Liverpool have certainly played their part in that. And if it wasn't for the juggernaut that is Manchester City, Klopp could be leaving Liverpool with sort of four or five Premier Leagues, and you suspect in some ways that this will galvanise his team to really push to try and get him a second Premier League this year and in front of the fans. But that aside, irrespective of how this season goes, he'll always be considered within the pantheon of great Premier League managers, won't he?
No, absolutely, and especially what he's done to kind of revolutionise the game over here as well, tactically in Australia. And it's kind of opposed to what Pep's done. It's more kind of, what did he say against Wenger? It's like his was a finely tuned orchestra and he preferred like heavy metal football. And I think you've seen that. It's up and at him in your face, the gig impression, of course. And I just think it's been a revolution to what, whereas Fergie wasn't quite the tactician, he was more the out and out total manager, kind of told these, always changed his coaching staff to keep that fresh, but gave them kind of a baseline, but basically left them to do what he wanted them to do over the course of the season, whereas Klopp and Pep are much more hands-on. But I suppose you've got to give some of the credit to his assistant Pep Linders in recent seasons as well for the role that he's come in since he took over as assistant manager. But you'll always be remembered as one of the Liverpool greats because he's won everything. But obviously, winning that league title for all those years that they hadn't won one really brings it to the fore that you've got to be careful for what you wish for and chasing away a manager like Arsenal did with Wenger, and Arsenal didn't win the title for numerous years before his reign ended. But as you've seen, it's been hard for him to be replaced and somebody else to win the title, and we're going now on 20 plus years now since Arsenal won the league. Man United are feeling the pinch as well, and Liverpool have got to be careful that obviously they're leaving on amicable terms and they're giving much a leading. But what you've got to do now is not just to say who's the Klopp kind of guy that can come in and immediately replace him. It's got to be how do we kind of minimise his influence in terms of he had a lot of autonomy at this club. Now how do we modernise the structure so it doesn't end up like a power vacuum, and the right guy comes in and he's more of a head coach rather than a full manager in terms of kind of having his hands in all the departments. So I do think it'll be interesting to see how they develop and move on from him. But in terms of what Klopp's done, and he says he won't be back to managing our English club, it's fantastic what he's brought to the fore for the last 9 years. And it's such a long tenure as well, considering how the churn of managers in England, especially these days, goes on, for him to be given that opportunity to do that for so long and be effective right from the off. And I think it was a case that there wasn't many German managers preceding him that had done very well in England either. So for him to kind of change the kind of minds of a lot of people's that foreign managers from German climes can do well and adapt to the game It's done well for his countrymen as well, and potentially one Julian Nagelsmann that can take the job off him if he wanted it, of course.
Yeah, that's a fair point, isn't it? Because there was this sort of group of German-influenced managers that came after them as well, whether it was in Germany, whether it was elsewhere in Europe, or whether it was in the Premier League pod favourite, Ralf Hasenhüttl, very much out of the German and Klopp school of thought. And it has changed things a lot. And it's made the Premier League quite interesting between the sort of Pepites and the Kloppites as to how other teams play and the styles that they copy as well, and the sort of clashes that leads to. Just having a look at the odds just now for his replacement, there's no surprise that Xavi Alonso is odds-on favourite as we speak, closely followed by De Zerbi, Ruben Amorim, Pep Linders, and then Nagelsmann. Then Unai Emery, quite interestingly, which would be fascinating to see him get another top Premier League job. But I think the point you make about the next person they bring in, it can't be for immediate success, is actually really important, because I think in some ways that's where Man United, I suppose, tried to go for David Moyes, didn't they? But they didn't really give him the time. But that tends to be where these teams make a mistake. Whereas when they replace the incredibly successful manager, they try and find somebody that's going to come in and be immediately successful themselves, and forget that, you know, Klopp took his first season wasn't terrific. His second season was when it was all starting to click into play, and then his third season was when he was absolutely sensational. And even Pep Guardiola at Manchester City, I think he finished third or fourth in his first season. It took it took him time to get it to click. So a long term appointment is definitely going to be the preference. But I suppose Alonso and De Zerbi would both fall into that category. Alonso's vying for the Bundesliga, Mike, but it is still very early in his managerial career. And I'd be surprised if he wanted to commit to taking on the Liverpool job next season already, sort of optically, given what's going on at Leverkusen, given the reputation that Leverkusen have for bottling it all the time, given that the club and the fans have given him an opportunity there, obviously, to develop his managerial career. It would feel a little bit like he's chucking it back in their face to announce in the middle of a Bundesliga title battle against the all-conquering Bayern Munich to say that he's going to Liverpool. But he does seem to be the obvious choice given his history with the club.
Yeah, I think that's what falls back on, because the way he sets out his Leverkusen team is very different to what Klopp would set out his Liverpool team. And it's not to say with the same group of players they'd be able to adapt and change his style or change in their approach into the way that they play games. But there's a lot less like long balls into the final third. It's a lot more build-up. It's more structured like Manchester City. So I think Xabi Alonso would actually be more suited towards moving to Real Madrid first before he went to Liverpool, even though that seems kind of the backwards way of doing it. So I can understand like with his history of the club, but I just don't think it'd be that perfect fit at the perfect time for the pair of them. Like you said, go out and do your craft first. And if that means that Real Madrid come calling, if he gets sacked off Real Madrid, you'll easily walk into another job anyway, because we all know that they always sack the managers eventually at one point or another. So I can understand that. De Zerbi, like, I think for Liverpool manager as well, more so than our clubs, the manager is a figurehead, and he has to get the city and he has to resonate with the locals as well, more so than perhaps other clubs. And I think that's why what tapped into Klopp greatly, obviously Kenny Dalglish after the Hillsborough disaster as well, able to tap into going on to all these funerals, doing off his own back. Shankly evidently bought into the kind of way of things were going, the same with Bob Paisley. So if you look at the absolute bastions of the club and the greats of the club, they kind of got the city as a whole, even if they're coming out as outsiders. And while Xabi Alonso knows the club, is he that personality as well that can immediately connect them? I worry. I think the perfect fit would actually be Postecoglou.
100%. I don't think so Liverpudlian, isn't he?
I don't think he'd be able to manoeuvre his way out of Tottenham to Liverpool immediately. But if they were able to pinch him, it's a similar kind of up and at him in your face brand of football. So I don't think he'd have to change his ideals too much, and the players wouldn't have to mould to his way as a big drastic change. But if they could, if he could get them, we all know the buy nights go off Tottenham fans immediately without having to do much off the bat. So I think he'd be the absolute perfect fit for them, but I don't think it's quite realistic.
And feel like, obviously, got no loved loss, particularly for Spurs as a Chelsea fan. Although, to be fair, I've never really held them in the same content as Arsenal or Fulham. But I would genuinely feel so sorry for Spurs fans to finally get a manager that they all get behind. That's a like really cool, really envied manager, and then he fucks off to Liverpool after 12 months. They absolutely, in the most tremendous way, it would be so Spursy. It'd be so Spursy to get a good manager and then to blow it in the first season. I think you're absolutely right. He's the Liverpool. Liverpool managers do have to be different. I think you never know unless you live places, and I'm sure lots of places feel very patriotic about their city. But certainly on a global, a national, but and then even then a global stage, Liverpool just has an identity in a footballing sense way above any other city. For me, way more than even Manchester. I don't think, you know, people in Europe would really understand Manchester as an individual identity within the United Kingdom in the same way that you always do Liverpool. Obviously, London's got far too many teams to have any kind of individual identity. I wouldn't have said, you know, Birmingham does at all. Newcastle's probably the only other one that you would say has a sort of really specific football-based noticeable identity. So I completely agree with you. And Klopp was, because he was heavy metal football, because he's rock and roll, also like really silly things, like because he's massive, like he's just a huge bloke, like an absolutely massive bloke. And it kind of creates this air around him that I think allows him to control, almost like a conductor, control the orchestra that is Liverpool Football Club around him, because he's got that kind of presence. And Ange Postecoglou is another guy with a physical presence that could come in and sort of be demanding. For me, I really, really hope Liverpool appoint Roberto De Zerbi, because I am absolutely certain it would be an unmitigated disaster. Like, all I've seen from De Zerbi is he's a moaning-faced bastard. Like, he constantly whinging. He's whinging about, you know, Brighton being a small club this and not having the right players that. And he's just, even when they win, he's not happy. When they lose, he's not happy. He's screaming and shouting at the referees. The only thing I think would work with him in Liverpool is that Liverpool also like to feel like there's a massive conspiracy against them by the man. And he would definitely tap into the, like, everyone's out to get us mentality within the Liverpool fans. But I honestly think he would be a disaster. I don't know, maybe it's probably for this part of the show rather than when we come on to the Brighton game. But I don't understand why, maybe you can enlighten me, Mike. I don't understand why he's necessarily getting the credit, because Roberto De Zerbi's also being touted for the Barcelona job. And I just, he's not, for me, doing anything remotely interesting at Brighton or overly special with that squad. Last year, I said all he did was carry on what Graham Potter did. He's had a summer and they've regressed. And I know they lost McAllister and Caicedo, but for me, they regressed. And I struggle to see what Liverpool would see as a long-term plan in appointing De Zerbi.
No, I don't think it'd be the right move for either of them. I think what it does, interestingly, is teams baited the press, and obviously everybody's kind of started to try and bring that into play as well. And there's one facet that worked for quite a bit, but then once you understand that, well, they're baiting the press, but you don't have to actually get baited by it. You can just stand off them. And I think that's where Brighton obviously struggled to break down teams. And as Luton showed, which we'll come into later, of course, like just getting in their faces from the off and putting them off the rhythm has a detrimental effect to them. And we've said this in the past that De Zerbi's always got one of these kind of, De Zerbi teams always have one of these kind of mad games where they will lose about 4 or 5-0. I think it was Everton last season who did similar. So I think you get the rough of the smooth, and while there's a stat going around, they've only won 3 of the last 16 Premier League games. Some of that's disingenuous as well, because I think they won 2 of the last 5, or two of the last six or something like that, and they've only lost one in the last six as well. So you can kind of manipulate the stats to what you want to look like. They've done well in the, I can't remember if it's the Europa League or the Conference League, but they've progressed through that as well. And
Europa,
I think we've said, I think we've said this as well, that their team of players is, they're probably getting better than the sum of the parts out of them. And we know this when they've sell players to other clubs as well, they probably find out that these are great system players in the way that Brighton are set up. But once you take them out of that and plop them in somewhere else and perhaps to ask them to do other jobs that they're perhaps not used to, more kind of familiar roles to, say, a defensive midfielder or a central midfielder, etc., they've just not got quite that top-level ability to go with it either. And I think there's obviously exceptions to the case, like McAllister is just a tremendous footballer wherever he got. He was just one of these South American gems that they got. But like Cucurella, like they pulled Chelsea's wool over their eyes there with him. I think Brighton are a team that's still punching well above their weight. And I think where we see regression, they're still top half. They probably still win top half. And if they get a good run in Europa League, I don't think that's a disastrous season by any means. But I just don't, you're right, I don't think he fits what Liverpool need right now. And I don't think the players would necessarily fit his profile and what he wants his team to be.
No, I completely agree. One other point I wanted to touch on in relation to Klopp leaving was just the players. I think there's been a lot of focus on being dubbed the last dance, which pisses me off because it's a misquote, but like it's not the last dance anyway. Last dance was very specific. But they talking about, you know, Salah, Robertson, Van Dijk kind of coming to the end, potentially coming to the end of their time at Liverpool as well, and sort of them all leaving it at once and it being a completely new rejuvenated generation there, and whether these players really want to have to go through a new manager. But for me, what would be slightly more interesting is what the mindset of, say, Dominic Szoboszlai, Alexis McAllister, to an extent, Luis Diaz, Darwin Nunez, like guys that have only been there, you know, sort of 18 months at most, and obviously came to play for Klopp and play in this system, and then he's leaving, and whether, yeah, what their mindset would be as well. I think any new manager that comes in is going to want to freshen things up a little bit with their own men and their own players, and I think it could be the case that actually, if anything, I would have thought your Van Dijks and your Salah, maybe less so Salah, but Van Dijk and Robertson probably will just stick around. I can't see where else Robertson really goes, to be honest. He doesn't strike me as a guy that's jumping for an Atletico Madrid or a Bayern Munich move, to be perfectly honest. So I would be really surprised to see them go. But actually, we might see more turnover in your, maybe not this summer, but January and next summer, with your Szoboszlai, Nunez, McAllister, that sort of latest collective of new Liverpool players.
No, it's distinctly possible, because like it's all hypothetical about who's going to come in, who's going to do what. I think like the perfect manager for them would be, it'd be a job swap for Klopp and Nagelsmann, because Nagelsmann's very tactically kind of astute in terms of he's not very principled and like this is the way we're going to do it. He's very adaptable to the players that he's got at his disposal. So I don't think he'd necessarily be looking to really shake things up and throw everybody out at once and get his own men in. But I think the only issue about him and his problem is he's cantankerous and he's a bit like Tuchel in the sense that he was always spoiling for a fight. And while I think that's good, like you said, with Liverpool who wanted to stick it to the man, I think the issue would be with the board more so than anything of looking and picking for a fight. It's a very short-term replacement. But in a sense, if you're trying to bridge the Klopp gap to another manager that you want to be there ideally for, say, 4 or 5 seasons, then 2 years on Nagelsmann might be actually all right to bridge that gap. And he gets his name back into the club scene. Say he has a decent Euros with Germany anyway. He's only an interim manager. His deal runs out at the end of the Euros. He'll be in high demand once again, even though he was poor at Bayern Munich, but he still had a good crop of clubs in the Bundesliga before then. So I think he'll be situated nicely, situate the club nicely. And I don't think too many players' noses will be out of joint immediately, and they can still grow and prosper and move on from there. So I do think I do think you still need a bit of transition in that team. Van Dijk's not getting any younger. Robertson's sitting 30, of course. Like I said, I don't think they'll necessarily jump anywhere, but you do need to see, right, who's going to be the replacement. And maybe we've seen that right back with Conor Bradley, of course. That could potentially slot Trent into the midfield. Like Trent's another one. I don't see where's Trent going to go necessarily. Like I don't. He's a Liverpool boy. If that team's always competing in the Champions League, unless Real Madrid come in, I don't see him really spoiling for a move anywhere
Even
else.
Even then, so. Actually, it's hypothetical, of course it is, and we don't know these players. But he just strikes me as a Gerrard, he'll be at Liverpool for his entire career. Barcelona could come calling, and he'll stay at Liverpool because he's a Liverpool boy. And as we've just said, there's such an identity there between the city and the football club. Why would he go anywhere else? But I actually was just about to use Conor Bradley as a transition to take us from the Klopp chat into the game chat. Liverpool running out 4-1 winners at Anfield against Chelsea. Pretty spectacular fashion. It was 4 going on 40, to be perfectly honest. It was a swashbuckling performance by Liverpool. They're first in the league since that Klopp news. And if there was any doubt if the players were going to be playing for them till the end of the season, you can certainly put that away. But the entire performance really, Mike, was epitomised by Bradley, young Irishman that's come into the fold. I think he was he on loan at Bolton last season? He was there, player of the year. And he's only come in because of the Trent injury in the sort of last couple of games, and he's been absolutely fantastic in both of them. And, you know, he got a goal and two assists in this game, and he was everywhere. He was everything that's good about Liverpool. He's everything that is good about their fullbacks and that they've sort of changed in the league over the last few years. He slotted into that team so perfectly that you actually question, what is he going to do if Robertson and Trent stick around? Because he's so good. But obviously, you know, trying to get Trent out of the team is going to be nigh on impossible. And it's certainly bad news for Calvin Ramsey. I can't imagine he's coming back into the fold anytime soon, given that performance by Bradley. But yeah, 20-year-old young lad comes in, Mike, and he was sensational.
No, absolutely. I was going to make the Ramsey point. That's probably killed his Liverpool career. But Ramsey's on loan at Bolton as well, so he could be the next player of the season and then come back and contend for the right-back spot once again. But it's exceptional when something like that happens. Obviously, he's not a homegrown boy, but he's been in the academy for a few years before he's made the step up to the first team. And it seems seamless. Now, these things can happen. He's fairly early in his tenure, but he looks like a real Dr. Water kind of player. And he's took it on his stride. And yeah, considering what you're living up to, is one of the best fullbacks in world football since you've joined the club. Must be a daunting prospect. But like I said, he just looked fantastic against a Chelsea team that wasn't up to much on the evening, but in general, it's a good Premier League side to really put yourself up against and try yourself against, especially with Chilwell's on that flank with you as well. So I think what he's done in the past couple of appearances has really give Klopp something to think about moving forward in the rest of his tenure. Can he just kind of slot Trent into the midfield? Kind of solves the six problem that Liverpool have had. And if you pair him with Szoboszlai and McAllister, I mean, that's a midfield full of like talent and really attacking prowess that can potentially blow teams away. So it's all looking up for Liverpool. And we've talked about how we've been missing players for a lot of the season, but the defence still looks rock solid. So as much as they are swashbuckling going forward, they still look steady at the back. And I know the Chelsea got a consolation goal, but it just looks like Liverpool could be one of these teams motoring towards the league. And even with the kind of Arsenal hanging about back and Man City getting into a decent run of form as well, it's really set up to be an entertaining kind of run into the last few months of the season.
Yeah, it's got all the, at the moment anyway, it's got all the makings of that season. Was it when, did City get 100 points and Liverpool got 99, where they both just won? They both won like 19, 20 games in a row at the end of the season. And just like, there was no real jeopardy, despite there only ever being 1 point in it, because both teams just won every single weekend. But it feels like it's got a bit of that about it. The difference this time is that Liverpool are the team that are slightly ahead. You know, it's funny, they're 5 points clear of Arsenal. And I remember you know, when we were younger growing up, you would have been like, oh, 5 points, like, aye, that could turn on the head if Arsenal, you know, keep winning the way they are. Nowadays, I'm like, 5 points? When are Liverpool going to drop 5 points? It's an absolute chasm. Like, it's, you can't see that at all. But they have had 6 draws this season. That actually really surprises me. That's quite a lot of draws. Liverpool were tremendous in the game. I think one of the big compliments of Chelsea over this season, doesn't need many, is that they've been very good against the top teams. You know, until this game, they were undefeated against Spurs, Arsenal, City and Liverpool, had generally performed very well in all those games, sort of blew Arsenal away and were slightly silly to end up not winning that game. Obviously, the 4-4 against City, the opening game of the season against Liverpool, people were like, oh, this Chelsea side looks all right. And then the crazy game against Spurs, where things kind of all went wrong for them. But in this game, they looked... men against boys is such a silly cliche, but they just looked tactically, physically weaker than Liverpool in every position all over the pitch. They seemed to constantly be losing their battles, players making silly mistakes, and, you know, epitomised by the fourth goal where Dizazi has a look to see if Diaz is there, sees Diaz is there and decides to do nothing about it and, you know, lets Diaz just wander in for a tap-in at the back post. It was absolutely abysmal. I think the only shining light for Chelsea, perhaps, Mike, is Nkunku coming on at half-time, getting a goal and generally just looking pissed off for the entire second half. Like, he very much had the air of a player that was like, what the actual fuck have you lot been doing for the last 6-7 months? And why is this where we are? And he might have the sort of ability and mentality to come into that side and maybe be a leader that they're missing. I didn't really see him enough in Germany to know if he's a sort of leader kind of player. But in that half, he certainly at least looked like he was the type of guy that would lead by example. Maybe more like a Drogba, if nothing else, because he just seemed, even when he got the goal, he seemed pissed off, as if to be like, for fuck's sake, like, you know, people are trying to congratulate him. He wants nothing to do with it. Maybe the only positive for Chelsea coming out of what was otherwise a pretty sobering day.
No, absolutely. And just the way that Nkunku roams around the pitch as well, makes such an impact to the front three that Chelsea kind of operate. And I just think that the way he's situated himself, like, he wants to thrive, and he's been set back by injuries, and he obviously wants to show himself and improve. But like he's come off of Conor Gallagher, and like, that's the captain of Chelsea. Obviously not in the night, Chilwell was the captain, but he's been the captain instead of like Thiago Silva. And I know Pochettino's kind of played down the captaincy role, but it's like, we don't think Conor Gallagher's good enough for a team that should be challenging for the top six. And it's not through lack of application or anything like that. It's just sheer talent-wise, he's probably not quite at that level. And while he's like a bit like a Wilfried Zaha, he's great at a smaller club in the Premier League, can stand a wee bit more, kind of be that flamboyant player. But it just shows the muddle that kind of Chelsea are in. Is that they've got all these kind of patchwork players trying to fit it all together, worried about kind of profit and sustainability now with the sanctions that are coming against Forest and Everton. But here's one signing that looks like, if he stays fit, can propel Chelsea up a few more places. And match with Cole Palmer, who's been a revelation, kind of out of nowhere, even though he came for big money, but everybody's kind of putting question marks on him because they've never seen him much at City. I do think there's the premise of a good starting 11 in amongst all the kind of malaise that is Chelsea Football Club at this moment in time, but they just can't seem to knit it together for like 2 or 3 weeks in a row. Was no recently that Chelsea won 3 games in a row for the first time this season or something ridiculous like that. So like, it's just not coming together. I know there's been injuries, etc., but everybody can fall back on injury excuses. It's how you kind of step up with your reinforcements, and I think that's what's kind of been lacking. I mean, Chuba Mukunaka's coming on for 19 minutes, and it's like, this is a guy who's bought for good money as well, and it's like, your face doesn't kind of seem to fit at this club either. So like, why are you here? And it's, that's the kind of thing that's always puzzling about Chelsea's recruit. It was just buy all these potentially good young players, fit them in, and then get to the managers like, right, you go sort it out now. And it's just like, it's not quite working, even though Chelsea have got a good manager, have got the good foundations of what could be a promising team going forward. But there's just so much kind of excess around the fringes of it.
Yeah, and they're in an interesting position that, you know, they're only a point behind seventh, which is almost certainly going to be a European place this year, and would put them above, you know, Newcastle, Man United, Brighton, you know, teams that, that generally people are positive about. So, and they're in a cup final. They, you know, they have just got battered by the team that they need to play. But, you know, it's a one-off game and anything can happen in a cup final. So in some ways, it could turn out to be an okay season in the end. But it is, I think what you say about Conor Gallagher is absolutely spot on. He gets so much praise. And I don't dislike the guy or think he doesn't deserve praise. But you see, like, sort of Chelsea influencers, you know, these guys with massive followings that are sort of our age that rattle off about Chelsea, and everybody kind of takes their word as gospel, saying, you know, that we can't sell Conor Gallagher, and I won't go back to Pataudry if we sell Conor Gallagher, and Conor Gallagher's everything that is Chelsea. He's everything that is wrong with Chelsea in the nicest possible way, in that if we think that Conor Gallagher is good enough and is one of our best players, then Chelsea are nowhere near where they should be, because he isn't good enough. He wouldn't get into the Liverpool team, the City team, wouldn't get into the Spurs team, despite them trying to sign.
I don't know about that. All the skips in the Spurs team.
Okay, fair. He wouldn't get into a full strength Spurs team. He might get in at the moment, but with skip. Yeah, fair enough. And he wouldn't get into Arsenal either. Arguably, wouldn't even get into that Villa midfield. Or even the Newcastle midfield, if it's fully fit. So I think we had this discussion before Christmas that Harry Maguire started playing well when Man United started playing shite, because that's the kind of team that he thrives in. And actually, that just shows what's wrong with Man United, is that because he's not good enough to do it when Man United are good. It's a very similar sort of theory with Conor Gallagher and Chelsea for me. He looks good in that team at the moment because they're not very good. And if they were good enough, I don't think he would be anywhere near it. And he bizarrely is, like, don't get me wrong, his effort is exceptional. He, you know, constantly runs, but it's kind of like the minimum you expect from a professional, isn't it? Particularly if you don't think they're good enough. And it is interesting that he's had to, like, reinvent himself, because at Palace he was a number 10, he was scoring goals, he was getting assists, he was linking up with Zaha and the strikers. At Chelsea, he's like this sort of all-round box-to-box guy. He's not a Lampard, he doesn't score goals, he's got none this season, doesn't really break into the box. And the more I'm talking about this, actually, it's coming out, what the fuck is he? Like, what even is he? Like, we're talking about how great he is. What is he? He just runs from box to box. He runs constantly, you know. And the other thing as well, that's sometimes a bit of a red herring, is he does this thing where he, like, presses the goalie, then the centre-back, then the other centre-back, and then he turns around and he's like, where the fuck is everyone? You're like, well, mate, because that's not what we're meant to be doing. Like, nobody else is doing that, because that was not the plan. And now you're just fucking out of position, because you're running around like a heedless chicken, chasing the goalie and chasing two centre-backs, and nobody else is with you. So what's the point? Like, you're actually just almost trying to look like a busybody without achieving anything.
Obviously, you'll see Chelsea more than me and pick up upon these nuances, but yeah, it doesn't quite fit a remit of anything you want apart from a busybody. And I think that's really the downfall of, I mean, there's that £50 million player these days, a busybody, because I mean, that's the amount of money that Chelsea want for him. Whether they get it or not is another question. I doubt he'll move today, and I doubt that the summer will be when they try and move him on, because obviously he's pure profit. If they do go on to sell him, that looks good in the finances, etc. But yeah, like you said, that he's everything in the nicest possible way. He's everything wrong for the club, that he's got to stand out, and he's got to be the level of the team kind of revolves around what he's doing, and that's just pressuring folk for the sake of pressuring out with his own kind of, look at me, I'm trying my hardest here. Why is everybody else not doing it? So yeah, unfortunately, he's on an XL there, but there you go.
It reminds me of Derek Young at Aberdeen. I love Derek Young at Aberdeen, but that's kind of all he was good for. And that is a comparison that you will not get on any other podcast. Moving on, Luton with an absolutely incredible result. 4-0 against Roberto De Zerbi's Brighton, lifts them out of the relegation zone for the first time in a while. And they were 2-0 up in just over 2 minutes, Mike, the fastest 2-0 lead in the Premier League since, I think, 1995, I read, was the stat. The 19th fastest goal in Premier League history to open the scoring. And you touched on it slightly earlier on the Brighton side of things. So let's start with the Luton side of things. And we were pretty critical. I think it was after week seven, we did our kind of, you know, I think we described them as having no plan and no, it was something like we had teams where it was like, they had a plan, but it wasn't working, or it was a shite plan. And then we had teams that had no plan and were shite. And I think Luton maybe fell into that category, which was probably true at the time. But you've got to give credit to... I've forgotten his fucking name.
Rob Edwards.
Yeah, Edwards. In his ability to learn about the Premier League, adapt to the Premier League, educate and improve his players, and they're starting slowly but surely to reap the rewards. And they absolutely battered Brighton in this game, and it's a result that didn't flatter them in the slightest, isn't it?
No. the problem is, when you give a team a two-goal head start, it doesn't matter how perceivably they are. You're going to get away with it. And I think the issue was three of the goals, two obviously from right off the bat, like their goals within the 6-yard box as well. And I know one of them is because Steele makes an absolute howler of coming out for the second. And the first is just great pressure and turning the ball over from kickoff, which, you know, Luton is very effective at doing. But it's like, you've got to expect that. You've got to expect from the off, Luton, for as much as they've got players inferior talent wise, by no means are they outshadowed. But listen, there's a reason they're playing for Luton, and there's a reason they're not playing for a Forest, a Bournemouth, etc. Like, they're going out, especially kind of third, they're going to outwork you, or going to try to outwork you, and you've got to understand from the off, right, first 2-3 minutes, just let's do what we do, pass the ball nicely, kind of settle things down, get the crowd to quell down, and then we can start going at them. And Brighton just fell into the trap that a lot of teams have done, and that's why they've been good scores at Kenilworth Road, I'm pretty sure. I think they've scored more often than not in every single game that they've had at home. I think they've scored 17 goals in 11 games. They're going to get at you. Teams like, I'm pretty sure they've scored against every big traditional big six that's come to Kenilworth Road this season. They ran Arsenal mightily close and getting some points off of them. You've got to be up for the battle, and I know it's just a hoary old cliche and anybody can kind of say and do it, but at Kenilworth Road, you have to be up for the battle no matter who you are, no matter how much quality you have on your side, because they know that they've got to make up the margins by just being unrelentless in the way that they come at you and not give you a second's peace.
Absolutely. And it's I heard somebody, maybe it was on TalkSport, saying that, like, it's just a very different stadium as well. There are no other stadiums like that in the Premier League. It's very tight. It's very loud. It's got a sort of more traditional feel and traditional atmosphere to it. So it just, the whole setting for these away team players is different, and yet you do need to be mentally in the right place if you're going to be able to overcome it and rely on your quality ultimately. But Luton, Mike, are giving themselves a genuine actual chance of dragging themselves out of this relegation battle. They now find themselves with a game in hand, 7 points clear of Burnley and 9 clear of Sheffield United, which, given the number of points that those teams have, is absolutely enormous at that end of the table. They're a point above Everton, again with a game in hand, and only one behind Forest, again with a game in hand. And Forest and Everton potentially with points deductions to come when the season ends as well. So Rob Edwards is doing an absolutely incredible job there. And I think, you know, everybody wants them. It's a bit patronising, but also, you know, true that everybody wants them to stay up just because they're such an interesting story. And it's nice to have a different team in the Premier League instead of Fulham, Burnley, Norwich, West Brom, Middlesbrough that we sort of have every year. They're sort of very much in the Brentford, Brighton school, but they've made a difference to the league since they've come in. The other side of the coin, we should talk about Brighton a little bit more. And Deserby, they're sort of like, you know, they're eighth, they're not having a bad season at all, to be perfectly honest, Mike. They're potentially challenging in the Europa League, but it just feels like they've regressed slightly from the levels that Graham Potter was kind of pushing them towards, and that is possibly to do with the turnover of players. But they don't seem to have I feel like last season you always had confidence in Brighton. You thought Brighton were going to win pretty much every game that they went into, that you thought that that they would challenge the big teams. You thought they would always be difficult to beat. Perhaps part of the issue this season is the number of goals they're conceding, 37 in 22. You need to go down to Bournemouth and Nottingham Forest before you get teams that are conceding more, and that just seems to be hamstringing them in almost every game.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the underlying numbers, they are what they are in reality as well. They're very close to what they're producing in terms of XG and XG against as well. So, like, I think what we've just seen is there's more eyes on De Zerbi now. Like, everybody in the league's kind of seen them once or twice before. So while it was new and it was interesting last season, you've quickly worked out the kind of patterns of playing, what they're doing. I think they are struggling. Obviously, Mitoma's a big miss with him and Parvist in the left kind of flank. I think they bring real kind of interest and dynamic to pair them for full-backs and wingers to kind of double up against. So I do think there's been that kind of facet that they have missed. They've not quite got the goal scorer. They kind of share the goals around. I mean, Hinshelwood for a long period of time was chipping in with important goals. And he was kind of a plug-and-play player that could play in numerous positions. And I just think that some of the summer signings haven't quite been pulled off. Like De Hood, who's kind of like one of these more experienced guys to bring in, he hasn't been getting a game. So the recruitment hasn't been absolutely spot on. But I just think they're fine. I mean, they're fine where they are. Well, it's not maybe as entertaining as it was last season. They'll be okay. I think they'll be quite happy with where they are. It's how they build on it for next season. Whether that's sneaking into European space to get some more money into the coffers as well, and off season adapting to the kind of Thursday Sunday schedule as well when it rolls around. I think they've done okay in their circumstances, but it's just how do they push on once again next season is the real kind of question with them going forward.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And let's be honest, if Brighton fans were complaining, they'd need to sort of remember where they've come from in recent seasons, and they've got a chance of playing Champions League football next year, which is surely sort of the thing of dreams for a Brighton fan. I met a Canadian Brighton fan in the pub yesterday when I was waiting for something for half an hour. It was quite interesting chatting to him. He decided to support Brighton because nobody else did, and he thought that they would be interesting, and fairly nailed that one, to be perfectly honest. He's having a good time of it now. But yeah, they're in the, I think they, did they qualify top of their group? So they get that weird like bye in the Europa League while the Champions League teams come in. So
They managed the groups. Like, and the group is, well, I know Ajax have been on a bit of a down period, but when you say Brighton beat Ajax and they beat Marseille, I think of that 10 years ago, 5 years ago, it would have been insane. So you've kind of got to remember where you've come from as well to the journey that you're getting to. And I think, listen, as a Brighton fan, if you're not happy, then you can get Brighton back in your box, as a great man once said.
Yeah, exactly. If De Zerbi goes, Mike, as a Potter back to Brighton, I was asking my Canadian friends yesterday, it seems like the most...
It'd be interesting, that.
Obvious choice, because he's never ended up anywhere. Apparently, he was going to go to Palace, but Palace decided against it because of their rivalry with Brighton, which maybe it's a big deal for those fans. It kind of feels really silly from where we sit, but we're obviously not Brighton or Palace fans. But he genuinely seems like that would be a really obvious rematch.
Brighton will have some sort of algorithm that will pop out a name, and it'll be a Turkish guy that's playing in the Romanian second tier or something like that.
And he's not even a manager yet. He's still a right back, and he's only 27.
And that'll be the next Brighton manager. He's some far-flung name that you've never heard of, and it'll turn out to be the next coming of the next managerial kind of revolutionary. So I think try to figure out who Brighton are going to sign and who Brighton are going to bring as manager. Only Tony Bloom and his algorithm knows.
Yeah, fair enough. We weren't actually really going to talk about any of the other results. I appreciate there's been six others, a couple of games tonight, just largely given, as we alluded to, the inconsequential nature of the outcomes of most of those games. One thing worth touching on is Neil Mopai doing the James Maddison dart celebration only for his team to get beat 3-2. And then when Poch was asked about whether it would motivate his players, he basically said, I hope not. I'm not for all this bravado nonsense, and the players should be perfectly motivated without something stupid like that happening. I think, what did he say? He was like, if the players something about trying to work out who's the most macho and they should just get in a UFC cage and have it out.
I'm gonna bring up the full quote. I hope not, because this is it. I'm not a fan of it. I don't like the whole bravado pushing people around. If you're brave about things, my players and their players get into a UFC cage and I'll see how brave they are. We're out there playing football, and that's what I want our guys to focus on, playing football. And then they should get motivated by stuff like that as well. So he wants them to get in a UFC cage. And
also, the way he said, see how brave they are, feels like he's digging out his own players as well. Like, he's like, you're a bunch of wusses. I see yous every day. And you don't want to get in a UFC and start fighting it out. I thought that was absolutely brilliant. Very, very Ange. But yeah, City winning obviously keeps them up there. Newcastle beat Villa, which I suppose is mildly interesting. Drops Villa out of the top four for the first time. But actually, one of the biggest talking points over the last few days is, as always, in respect of Manchester United, who are playing tonight against Wolves.
I think Wolves is right, aye.
It's tonight away to Wolves. West Ham are playing Bournemouth. But is Marcus Rashford, Mike, getting a private jet over to Ireland to have a couple of nights out with his former teammate and pal? He was marked down as being unwell for the game at the weekend, which seems to be Man United's go-to for every time something fucking daft has happened. Because I seen on Twitter when he was first announced as being unwell, a lot of Man United fans saying, now, if we had the most unwell players in the league this season, like, folk are constantly unwell. And needless to say, it came out that he'd had a few indiscretions that Ten Hag wanted to deal with. But it is an interesting one to talk about, Mike, because I think it seems very specific to Man United this year. Last year, players like Sancho, Rashford, Ronaldo causing problems. And so there's that element to it, and Ten Hag sort of, despite being this authoritarian, his inability, it seems, to be able to control his dressing room. And then the other side of the coin is just what's turning out to be a really overwhelmingly disappointing career for Marcus Rashford in the round, given the way that sort of England fans and Man United fans pin so much hope on him. So I suppose start with the first one. You know, it's another dressing room difficulty for Ten Hag, and he seems to be dealing with this one just as badly as he has all the others.
There's no issue with Rashford going across, because the timeline is, he trained Wednesday morning, yeah, he got a fight Wednesday afternoon, goes to Belfast, was it Shaw Williams, his friend from the academy, played for Lairn, he just signed for them, goes out Wednesday night, that's all fine, he stays the Thursday, comes back late, ill for training, ill for the game, and it's just like,
he missed training, didn't he? Like, he didn't get back, or he got back so late that he couldn't get himself up for training or something like that.
Then phoned in sick, saying he couldn't make it. It's just like you're taking piss yourself. It's like you've just got back into the kind of form that potentially will prepare you to an England squad back for a World Cup, Euros year as well. And it's just like, why are you self sabotaging yourself? For the sake of two nights out in Belfast. Like, never been to Belfast, I'm sure it's perfectly pleasant, etc. It's just like, the one night will do you. It's like, you don't need to go two nights. And you're right, it's just like, it's another situation with it. Things have got out of hand, and he seems to be letting himself down. You can say, oh, he's a grown man, he can do what he wants. But he's got PR agency, etc. So he obviously cares about his public image. And it's just like, who's in his inner circle saying, like, maybe just wrap on the knuckles after the first night. Like, let's get back home. Even if you can't be arsed with training, etc. But it's just like, you can phone in sick there. Don't take the piss, because everybody's got cameras. This thing's going to get out. You know it's going to get out. So
just show up for work, isn't it? Yeah. It's like do what you want in your spare time, as many people do. But show up for work. Like you have to show up for work, whether you have our jobs or whether you have his job. Like, it doesn't matter what you do in a Tuesday or Wednesday night, you've got to be at work the next day as a bare minimum.
Yeah, and just like Ten Hag's, like, I think he did all right with Sancho, because I think people forget he gave Sancho a lot of time last season to potentially get himself right, whether that was mentally or physically, whatever it was. He went to Spain for a few months, worked on his physical training there, kind of took himself out of the Manchester bubble. So Ten Hag afforded him that opportunity, and then obviously he comes up with that ill-advised statement, doesn't apologise, and then he sees himself back at Dortmund, and he'll probably have a fantastic time there. The Ronaldo thing, I think he did well with the Ronaldo thing because we know what he's like as a kind of character around the place. I'm not saying he was bringing the morale of the team down, but everything had to revolve around him, and he was at a stage of his career where if you want to succeed in the park, you can't be, your team can be revolving around an aging superstar. So I think he did all right here, but with the Rashford thing, he doesn't seem to be able to get a grasp of him. He went out in October for his birthday, and that was just more of an ill-advised situation after a derby defeat.
Straight after the derby defeat,
It's like, fair enough. But even then, it's like, again, it's the inner circle thing. It's like, you know that's not going to be a good look, and you know that's not going to be well reflected on. Okay, he's just celebrating his birthday. There's nothing nefarious going on about the thing, but it's like, you've got to understand that situation. People are not going to be happy. And maybe just like I'm sure his house is big enough. I'm sure he can rent a place on his own that's big enough. With those around them, like, just have a quiet, private kind of affair rather than a local, you're out and about in the town centre kind of occasion. So the player's got to take responsibility.
And it just comes with being a footballer, doesn't it? Like, I know that I'm all for players being able to do stuff and live normal lives, and we're all human beings and have normal human desires and worries and anxieties and stuff. But to an extent, it does come with the territory of being a football player, doesn't it? Like, you can't just go and celebrate your birthday because it's your birthday, because that's what normal people do. Like, you, unfortunately, if you see it that way, have to accept that you can't go on a night out after you get fucking pumped by Manchester City. Like, you just can't. Like, and if you want, like, exactly like you say, if you want to do something, hire a private venue, get some mates around your gaff, just do something a bit more sensible. It just seems that Rashford is making the wrong decision at almost every opportunity, and like almost like a petulant teenager, sort of like acting out against his parents. Like, you don't want me to do this, so I'm gonna go dye my hair anyway, or I'm gonna go and get my ears pierced, or I'm gonna get a tattoo, or like, I'm not gonna go to uni for 2 years and I'm gonna go and do something else. And like, that, he just seems to be doing this weird, like, attempting to wind up the manager. Is there any element to it, Mike, you think he's angling for a move?
Apparently he's on $325,000 a week. So somebody's going to have to pay commensurate to that as well. So you're not performing on the pitch. I guess somebody will always take a chance, of course. But your kind of pool of teams that can do that is relatively small. Like, for natural reasons, he's not going to go to Liverpool anyway, because Liverpool don't pay those wages in the first instance, never mind the kind of rivalry aspect to it. Of course, he wouldn't go to City because City are filled with superstars. Not the right fit with Pep Guardiola. Arsenal, I mean, Chelsea maybe, right? Bully's mad enough today.
He's such a Chelsea signing, wouldn't he?
And then it's like, even if you're Marcus Rashford, there's probably better clubs in London than there is in Manchester, so that's not going to be good for his social life. And then you're looking at Real Madrid, they've probably got their eyes set on, maybe if it's 5 years ago, maybe. But they've got their eyes set on like Kylian Mbappe's at the moment, so no, the Marcus Rashford's. So then you're left with PSG, but they seem to be transitioning away from the kind of like just the big marquee names. They want players of substance now to try and move forward and win the Champions League. So then that leaves Saudi Arabia, doesn't it? And then if you're Marcus Rashford and your PR and et cetera, you've seen what happens with Jordan Henderson getting raked over the coals. So it kind of leaves them in a situation where it's just like, are you just unhappy because you're not happy with your club and you know there's kind of no way out and you're just kind of going about things in your own kind of manner and you're going kind of way and thinking, oh, well, I'll outlast Ten Hag. But it just seems to be a kind of a succession of managers where Rashford's done things that are a bit kind of opposite to what he's perceived as a public figure. And of course, all the good work they did during COVID with the free school meals, etc. He's evidently got that in him, but I just think sometimes maybe he's not surrounded by the right people to make him help him make the right decisions. And like you said, he's not a petulant teenager anymore. He's a 26, 27-year-old man.
And he's got to know
better. Yeah, he's got to know better with putting himself in these situations. Even though you do daft things in your 20s, like, you've grown up in a professional environment now for the best part of a decade. You've got to know this is going to reflect badly on you, especially as like a son of the Manchester Academy as well. It's like, there's no way Fergie would have stood for this. He would have stepped out immediately. And that's just kind of the sad thing about it is, oh, as well as like, Rashford probably knows himself that he should do much better on the park and off, and he's just not living up to probably his own personal pride more so than anybody else's expectations of him.
Yeah, he's very much. I use this as a metric, which is so insulting, but he's very much staring down the barrel of a Theo Walcott career, isn't he? Ultimately, he had a good 6 months at the back end of last season, a good World Cup followed by a good 6 months, but it's been atrocious since. And you really don't know what's next for him. Maybe he does just need a move and he's bored and needs a change and all that kind of thing. But it's just bizarre. It just like your reaction to it is just always like, why are you being an idiot? Just don't, like, there's not, you don't need to delve too much into the ins and outs of it in some ways, do you? Just stop being a fanny and just screw the nut a little bit and try a bit harder and show that you care and that you're interested and be the role model that you're sort of perceived to be. They play Wolves tonight. I suspect Rashford won't be in the team, or certainly won't be in the starting lineup, despite what Ten Hag said about it being dealt with internally. It'll be interesting to see what goes on there, as obviously their troubles continue on the park and they find themselves facing against England's shining light of tactical management and Gary O'Neill in the other dugout. Wrap up the English stuff with some transfers, Mike. It's been a dead January, possibly the quietest, not just from a financial perspective, but from a news perspective, as I can remember, genuinely, as far back as I can remember.
Yeah, everybody seems to have got the kind of shares up them with the profit and sustainability, don't they? A lot of people run into problems. I think last year, what was the story that came out? It was something like $8 billion was spent on transfers last year as a whole. And obviously, a lot of that would have been in the Premier League. And this season, you're right, like, who's the big names that are moving? Dragostin to Tottenham was a decent buy for a decent amount of money. You're seeing some moves potentially in the works today. Werner to Spurs, but even though that's only on loan. So yeah, it's just, like, even the rumour mill, like you said, it's not been a flow with a big name's going to come in late in the January. It's always been everybody's staying pat. And I think some of that goes down to as well that the Euros are coming up. You're kind of a limbo about your situation. You're kind of get a game where you're locally, like, you don't want to make that move and potentially jeopardise going to it, especially if you're in an England team, a Belgium team, one of the top nations as well. So I do think some of that plays into it. But yeah, like I said, it's been definitely quiet in terms of the English transfer window. And the whole kind of world revolves around the English transfer window because that's where the flow of money comes from. So obviously, if Genoa get the money for Dragostin, they go out and sign potentially two or three players with that money, and it kind of just drips down and it drips through. So it's kind of like being in a housing chain in many aspects. Like, you're waiting for somebody else to move on, so you can, that frees up for you, and then you can move about your own business. So I think that's, and Spain as well, obviously Barcelona's in great financial turmoil. They can't make the signings. Real Madrid are waiting for Mbappe, so that money's not being freed up for other clubs to spend either. So I do think it's a case that everybody's just in a holding pattern for the summer, and potentially opens up a wee bit more. But I think with what's happened with Forest and Everton in terms of the Premier League, a few teams that potentially would maybe dipped in would have thought themselves, well, because we potentially think that the bottom three is going to be the bottom three, we'll just hold on for the summer and maybe see what's going to happen then.
Yeah, I think it has been really fascinating. Because last year I feel like there was some big January transfers last year, which have sort of, well, Nkunku to Chelsea, but it didn't come in until January, but until summer, sorry. Yeah. But there was a few.
Was he last year?
Yeah, he was, wasn't he? Man United have still got that in them today. They could still go out and maybe they'll pay $25 million for Chris Wood this time and get him off of Forest. But Scott McKenna to Copenhagen on loan, Mike, quite an interesting one. Seemed to have just got shut out of Forest. Something must have happened that perhaps we're not aware of. But, you know, he was playing every week for Forest and then, bam, he's not in the team anymore.
I think it was contractually. It seemed to be an issue, and he fell out with Steve Cooper, and that was the case with club captain, who the name was Joe Worrell. They got told to train with the reserves, along with the $1,000 Nottingham Forest players. One transfer, actually, that's funny as a kind of sidestep. Forest have signed two goalkeepers in the summer, and they're now looking to sign a third goalkeeper, which epitomises everything about that club. But I do think McKenna to Copenhagen is interesting because they play Man City in the Champions League, Of course, I do think that it's an interesting club. It's a club in a very good division. Of course, it keeps his eye in at the Euros as well for Scotland, so it gets him back into Steve Clark's mind as well. But I think it's a fantastic platform for him to go out and see if he's capable of taking that step into the different league, a foreign climb, and excelling as he did with Forest for the first two and a half years he was there before he got exiled by Cooper as well. So I do think it's a potentially interesting move for him going forward.
Yeah, it is. It is very interesting. Hopefully, so is he out of contract in the summer? Is that?
I believe so. I believe that is.
Yeah, it's really fucking annoying because we've probably got like a 10-15% sell-on clause with him that's going to go down the fucking tubes, which, you know, would have been nice if we could have got something for him. But yeah, really, really interesting move. And funny that he'll end up playing Man City in the Champions League, which is a team that he's obviously played several times over the last 18 months. Otherwise, Mike, Villa finally got their man, which you wanted to mention, and I don't know if there's any other at all to talk about.
I think in terms of transfers, it's not going to be the Jim White extravaganza that transfer deadline day used to be back in the heyday, but I think you'll see the occasional move. I think it'll be a bit more interesting in Scotland what develops in terms of loans coming in from the English system, whether that's the top flight or even clubs like myself and Dunfermline, who are perhaps waiting for kind of the drip down effect to come into place. So I think in Scotland recently has actually been more interesting with names coming through the door, just because it seemed to be a lot of unknowns rather than any big names coming to the fore.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking of Scotland and changes, the big one yesterday, Aberdeen parted ways with their manager, Barry Robson. Almost, what was it, a year and a day since he took over as interim from Jim Goodwin. You can start setting your calendars by Aberdeen sacking their manager. That's three times in a row. They've, end of January, early February, they've dismissed their manager. And back to the drawing board for the club. Unfortunately, Mike, Aberdeen had no option, as we've discussed, but to give him the job back in April, May time when they did, given his run of form and given the way that the season ended for Aberdeen last year. But it's been pretty apparent for a long, long time now that he was probably out of his depth and didn't have the tactical wherewithal to get the best out of what is genuinely a good squad of players at Pittodrie. And his style of football was awful. I was going to say disappointing. It was awful. And the results as well. You know, I've seen some fans say, you know, it's a disgrace if they win both their games in hand, they'll finish, you know, they'd be fourth. And I think these other fans are forgetting that there's absolutely no chance of us winning both our games in hand. That's the problem, you know. Again, until we played Dundee, we had three games in hand and we'd have been right behind Hearts again. But we didn't beat Dundee because that's not what we're doing this season. You know, games in hand are not a guaranteed 3 points. And the way we're playing at the moment, they're far from it. So not a huge surprise in the end, Mike. And actually, perhaps a surprise it took longer than it should have.
The Robson style of play was like lamentable for the midfield that you have to bypass it so regularly. I thought it was extremely disappointing. The fact he's my Aberdeen manager, probably the third biggest club in the country, and they could only seem to play well when they were underdogs. And he did get into the cup final. I mean, there's potentially rumours if he lost the semi against Hibs, then he would have been out in his ear, and I think it would be justified at the time as well. I think I put in the group chat is like how many managers have come into Scotland in the recent year and they've had like no managerial experience whatsoever. So like Robson, of course, he's been in the club for a while, he knows it, etc. But he's never taken a top job and he's walking into a role that Ferguson did a great job with in the past. Derek McInnes did in recent times as well. And like you shouldn't be walking into the third biggest job in the country off the back of training, being a Bibbs and Coleman man for like the youth team. Stephen Glass was a bit of a disaster as well. And Jim Goodwin, like at the time the appointment made sense, it just didn't come out to be a good one. And obviously the Darvel debacle will live long in the memory. And he was rightly dismissed after the terrible Hibs game the following Saturday after. So this is three successive managers that Dave Cormack's been in charge of making, or been the head honcho of making.
Yeah, it's the fourth. This will be his fourth appointment. Yeah,
in 4 years, and none of them have been up to scratch, and they've all been kind of different kind of elements of what you kind of want a manager. Like Goodwin, who obviously made his way up from Alba to Cimarron to Aberdeen, that is like a natural progression. Just unfortunately didn't work out. Stephen Glass, like there was links between him and Cormack, obviously with the Atlanta United side. It was interesting at the time. There was a semblance of what he wanted his Aberdeen team to be playing. It just didn't come off. He perhaps, in a sense, should have got more time. If you really believed in him, as that was going to be the project, and him taking that team forward.
But he did also have a bad team. I mean, it's worth it. Like, actually, when you look back at it, Glass had a really abysmal side that, you know, Scott Brown, an aging Scott Brown and whatnot in that team compared to the players they've got now.
Whereas Robson is like, you spent good money on, was it Pape Gay? Couldn't they get a tune of him? I noticed you, Conor and Greg in the chat have said previously that, Kieran and Greg have said in the chat previously, like, he doesn't make his substitutions. Like, he just sticks to the team that he's got, and people get like a few paltry minutes down the line. There's the issue of Conor Barron, whether he's going to sign a contract or not. You boys will know better. I think he's got a fantastic prospect of having a great career. But
he's our best youth player in decades. He is absolutely, probably since Ryan Fraser, the one that you're like, this guy can make it. Like, this guy's absolutely brilliant. And the fact that we could lose him to Celtic for fuck all is mental.
Yeah. And he just doesn't get a game. So whether he's going to sign a contract or not, just for him to be kind of languishing in the kind of bench or the reserves isn't good enough. And like we've all said it, we've all agreed that Aberdeen's got a good squad about them. It's just the application of it. It's just not been up to scratch. And it needs, what does it need? It needs, probably at this moment in time, it needs a Derek McInnes kind of figure. It needs an experienced head at the role who can come in and kind of just settle everything down. Get them playing I don't mean just like running the mill football, but just get them playing football, give them a lift, give them a confidence boost. If you can push them into the top six, then go and build upon it from there. It's all fine and well having a project manager, but one, if you're not going to give them time to implement it all, then there's no point in doing so. And all the stuff behind the scenes looks like it's going well. It looks like your club's been run properly, but just on the park, you've not made the right managerial choices. And the names that have been brought into the job just seems to be now I know it's betting odds, it's a list, it doesn't necessarily mean that's the short list that Aberdeen are going to draw from, but it just seems like there doesn't seem to be a semblance of you can put your finger on what Aberdeen are looking for. It seems to be a scattergun approach to what this next appointment may be. Now Neil Warnock would be hilarious for multiple reasons, but I don't think that's a long-term solution to an answer to anything. But like even just like some of the names are like Stephen Robinson, is just like, you just hired a St Mirren manager. It's like, this isn't Ferguson you're hiring now. It's nobody that's going to go on to have the career that he once had. So I wouldn't go down that path again.
It's lazy, isn't it? It's lazy. Yeah. Just like, oh, here's a guy that's doing all right in the league that we're in. We'll just get him. Like, there's no imagination to it.
And it goes to the other side of the argument as well. It's like, you see Reece McCabe mentioned. I also think this is a lazy argument as well. It's like, oh, here's a guy whose team strings three passes together. Let's get him up. And it's just like, look, Reece McCabe might be a fantastic manager going forward. He might be great at Aberdeen and might do wonders and lift the League Cup with him, etc. But just because it's a new fancy kind of style of name doesn't mean you just, right, let's plop him up here, let's put him in there. That's not really how it works. It's not how it should work. That's just lazy the opposite way. So I do think like they need to bash their heads together. They need to understand what they want this club to be, and it's the third biggest club in the country, so it needs to be competing with Hearts and Hibs on a regular basis for third and get into the European positions. It's like you've not spunked the money that you've earned this season, but like you spent a good chunk of some of it on players who don't appear to be good enough or obviously can't get a tune out of. So you need to get in somebody that immediately can kind of rectify those issues. Somebody that wants to play a style of football that is more attractive, less underdog mentality, more front foot, more dogged, kind of up for the fight, and utilise that midfield that's excellent and feeding into the likes of Miofsky in attack, because he's one of the best strikers in the division, never mind just outside the Old Firm. So like you've got to play to your strengths, and I think Robson's failed that miserably.
Yeah, absolutely. Bojan's an incredible player that we potentially waste. I would say he is the best striker in the league. I think he's absolutely exceptional. Conor Barron, brilliant midfielder. We've got the core of a good team. We play dreadful football. We need experience, but we need somebody to come in that does have a style of sort. I don't really care, like, kind of agree with you with this, like, lazy the other way. Like, I don't care if Aberdeen turn into Man City. I really don't. Derek McInnes didn't have a great style of football, to be perfectly honest, but it worked and it won us games. That's kind of more what would be important. Utilise the good players in midfield, of course, and try and get some of the better football players onto the pitch if we can. But I just don't want us to... In some ways, I don't want us to rush. In other ways, we can't take our time either. You know, you can't have a situation like we had last year where the interim was in charge for sort of 10 games and then you went, oh, fuck it, we'll just stick with him. So hopefully we are able to make moves a little bit faster than we did last year. I think a big difference maker in the appointments so far to this appointment is it's the first one Alan Burrows has been actually involved in the process from the start. Now, he would have had his feet under the table by the time Robson got given the permanent job, but I could, like, literally had to give it to him. You know, the guy won 7 games in a row and then got us third in the league and straight into the Europa group stages. You had to give it to him. So I don't really hold that against Burrows. The problem was not finding somebody in February, which was before, you know, Burrows arrived. And so hopefully he makes a positive impact on the recruitment process. He's done a fairly solid job at Motherwell in terms of them recruiting reasonably well in his time there and allowing the club to punch above its weight a little bit. So that's got to be a positive. And interview guys and just give it to the best one. You know, I don't care if he's Scottish, English, foreign, Brazilian. I really don't. Like, it's not a case we must go get a foreign manager, because I don't think that's necessarily correct. We just need to get the best manager for the job at the time. You know, the Airdrie manager might be playing great football. It's probably going to be too early in his managerial career to be jumping to Aberdeen. I've seen somebody suggest Kevin Thompson because he did a great job at Celtic. And you're like, well, good for him, but he's also not had a job for 18 months.
Of course. I was also going to say Kevin Thompson thinks that's a great idea. So,
Yeah, exactly. Like, and they literally said, oh, he doesn't get the credit he deserves for his League Two win. And you're like, well,
I know who you're talking about. He said that on Twitter. I wouldn't make any credence, Christ. He still goes about Ryan Gold getting a game for Scotland. So that wouldn't make
any just trying to be contrary for the sake of being contrary. It was just like, come on. It's a shame. It's disappointing. It had to happen. Everybody was fed up. We need a new manager. Hopefully it's a good one. Warnock would be a laugh till the end of the season, if nothing else, at least.
The thing is, until the end of the season, he'd be perfect, because that's what he's suited to doing.
Yeah.
That's what he's absolutely suited to doing these days, just getting everybody, putting the arm around the shoulder, giving everybody a lift. It's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be a great watch, but he will get a lift out of these players.
He will, and he'll have some great sound bites in his interviews, and he won't hear about the old firm. I'd love to hear him do a you've got a fucking die for 3 points speech at some point. Like, he'd be fucking blockbuster. And I think the most disappointing thing is that, not doing this earlier, is that this is the last season that third will get automatic group stages in the Europa League. Everything will change from next season. Scotland are way down the coefficient. It's going to be incredibly difficult to qualify for the new competitions. And so Aberdeen have sort of chucked away 5-6 million quid by being so shit this year. And I don't think anyone's going to catch it. Hearts aren't going to capitulate like they did last year. They're not very good, but they're good enough that they'll turn that, was it a 13-point gap or something? Well, it's more than that, but with the games in hand. So at best for Aberdeen, a sort of 13-14 point gap. They're not going to be able to turn that around this time. So you may as well get Neil Warnock in and have a laugh about it and give the club 6 months to find a long-term solution. If he provides that, I guess it would be a positive.
Failing that, Dick Campbell. Similar job, just different nationality. Sound bites, good crack, advancing in age, just all the check boxes of Neil Warnock, just Scottish instead of English. And like I said, he'd give the place a lift.
He absolutely would.
And just having a manager with the bonnet in the top flight, can't remember, maybe the 60s, the last thing that I
have. And he'd have to be part-time because he's got his business to run on the side. So we'd have to get him in part-time, which would be... Dick Campbell would be a laugh. Joking aside, one name that keeps getting touted about is Neil Lennon. Absolutely anybody but Neil. Like, mental. I genuinely can't believe people are actually touting Neil Lennon for the Aberdeen job. Absolute madness. Like, never mind the fact that, you know, a sort of Celtic and anti-Aberdeen-based career, but just, like, he's shown nothing in the last decade to suggest that he's a remote league manager. So, you know, even just in his own credentials, I don't want anything to do with him. Same with Jack Ross. Like, come on to fuck. We don't want anything to do with Jack Ross. Like, we dodged that bullet the first time. I've seen Malky Mackay, which, again, would be absolute fucking madness. So, yeah, actually, I want Neil Warnock to come in to save us from doing something that stupid and allow us to, you know, go to Spain and get somebody really cool, like a guy from the Spanish sixth tier that we have borrowed Tony Bloom's algorithm to find to come in and lift the club to new heights. I think that'll probably do us there, Mike. Good chat. Bit more on the, a bit broader than perhaps other weeks, only kind of covering the two games, but there was plenty to talk about. Anything else from you before we call it?
No, I'll just be interested to see what Dunfermline do the rest of the day in terms of transfers. I think he was talking about bringing in another centre-half, so it'd be interesting if we can get another one over the line because we're lacking in terms of depth in those numbers. But it doesn't have to be today because if you're a lower league club in Scotland, you can pinch from the top tier clubs in Scotland for the rest of the month as well. So it doesn't have to be done today. But if he's English-based, then it will have to be done today. And yeah, I think in those aspects, I think that's where the transfer deadline day is going to be interesting, just in terms of the Scottish names that are going to be moving and shaking around the place.
Yeah, absolutely. Keeping an eye out from that throughout the day and, like you say, possibly for the rest of the month as well, to see if Dunfermline can make a push for the playoffs, which would be absolutely fantastic. Well, thank you very much for your time, Mike. Enjoy the rest of the day. Enjoy the weekend. Lots of great football to come. Of course, with another set of Premier League fixtures thick and fast starting again on Saturday. And we'll catch up again next week. Cheers.